Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the United Religions Initiative, Global Indigenous Initiative, and Now Time Radio's presentation of Indigenous Voices. Indigenous Voices airs every other Thursday on Now Time Radio at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Indigenous Voices features Indigenous artists, activists, wisdom keepers, and spiritual leaders raising their voices to bring messages from an Indigenous perspective on cultural heritage, women and children, the environment, our relationship to Mother Earth, preservation of sacred sites, human rights, spirituality, religion, and interfaith. The United Religions Initiative is a global grassroots interfaith network that cultivates peace and justice by engaging people to bridge religious and cultural differences and work together for the good of their community and the world. To join the call during Indigenous Voices on Now Time Radio, call 424-243-9656. You may also live stream or listen to the podcast at any time at www.blogtalkradio.com/Now Time Radio. Good afternoon. This is your host, Audrey Scott Williams. And today we're going to take a journey to the Down Under territory. We're going down to Australia, where last night I had an opportunity to interview two people who were a part, actually, of the Trail of Dreams World Peace Walk, in the sense that the Karanda Mob, and I want to give a shout-out to our Karanda Mob, that hosted us there. And so we had what might be called a cuppa and a good yarn last night as we talked about the indigenous issues affecting the community there at the Mana Mana Mission and in the Karanda area and Australia as a whole. So I'm really excited about the show today. In fact, I feel really good. So I'm going to start out with some music from Down Under. This is by Jeremy Donovan, and it's all about the didgeridoo. I want to forward
a bit here, actually going back to a previous show, I want to show the connections between indigenous peoples around the planet. And when I heard this particular selection by Jeremy Donovan with the Didgeridoo, it immediately brought me into the remembrance of the Altai Kai song that I played when we interviewed Zoya from the Altai Republic. So I want to play a little bit of this so you can feel the connection between what we just heard and Altai in Siberia, Russia. Well, I'm sure you can tell, just as I could, the rhythmic connection, the sound, the vocal sound of toning with the Altai performers, as well as the tone of the didgeridoo. So thank you for indulging me in my moment there. But our guest today on our show that was pre-recorded last night is Glynis Grogan. Glynis is part, again, of our Karanda family up there in the rainforest in North Queensland. We had an opportunity to talk about, specifically I was interested in Glynis sharing her work that she's been doing as a health advocate, a nurse, a human rights advocate, and advocate for social justice, as well as artist. I wanted her to share about her experiences with her work with the Stolen Generation. And so we're going to begin our interview with that. I also asked her to talk about the role of art in the recovery of the memory of the ancient Aboriginal ways. Because of colonization, there were so many affronts on the culture that many of those old ways were lost. And so she shares that. And then we're going to hear from Coralie Wasson, and who is an artist and has been exhibited in many of the museums, especially this in the Sydney International Airport, many of the museums in Australia and hotels all have her artwork. And we're going to talk about one particular piece of hers that I want to share more with as we listen to the interview. So I want to begin now with Glynis and Coralie from Karanda, which is in North Queensland up in the rainforest.
I love Karanda. You know, that was one of our favorite places on our walk. I know that you're an artist, and I know from when we, even when we were there, you were organizing the artists in the community and trying to represent their work and help them to get to be able to promote their work and get paid for the work that they were doing. And I think at that time you were Coralie, and you were partnering in that, and I think there were others who were a part of that. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. But what I would like to do to begin the interview is go even before that. I remembered you showing me a lot of documents and sharing information on the Stolen Generation.
Yes.
And I was thinking we could start there and talk about what that was and the impact that it's had on community, and how with art it's helping to transform perhaps and affect healing and bringing greater awareness back to indigenous ways.
Okay, well, for Australia, I think since colonization, or rather in the wake of colonization, there's been a lot of issues that indigenous people have to deal with. And it started with every government in Australia back after colonization actually sanctioned the forced removal of children, but then extended to the forced removal of large groups of people. With my grandmother, for instance, she was stolen from Maytown. She was a little half-caste girl, and all the half-caste kids were being picked up and put into mission institutions or places where they could put Aboriginal people out of sight, out of mind. The troopers chased her for 3 days before they were able to catch her, and she was asleep in a tree. And once they got hold of her, they walked her 3 months overland with a whole group of other children from Maytown, which is just at the beginning of the Cape York region of Australia, of North Queensland, and they walked her overland to Cairns Police Station and then to the Cranbourne Police Station before they put her onto the Seventh-day Adventist mission. And that's my story, and there's a lot of other Aboriginal people who have similar, if not worse, stories where children were regularly stolen. And when settlers came into areas, and particularly in our areas, well, Aboriginal people or the tribal traditional owners of that particular area was actually rounded up and also put in on the mission. And in some cases, it was safer for Aboriginal people to be there because of the massacres and the mass sort of hunt, I would say, of Indigenous people to remove them off their land so that the colonisers could take it over. So that, of course, with the history since the late 1700s and our areas in the late 1800s or mid to late 1800s, that caused a lot of heartache and grief for Aboriginal people. Only in 2012, I got involved with the National Stolen Generations Alliance, which is a government-funded advocacy body on behalf of the Stolen Generations. But all my life, we were arguing but actually working towards getting justice for Aboriginal people. 5 years ago, they had what was called the Ford Inquiry in Queensland, where people who were institutionalised into state government, who were put into state government institutions, were actually paid compensation. Whereas with the people of Mona Mona, where my family has come from, and that they were put into dormitories as young as 4 years of age or even younger in some cases, they weren't able to access that any form of compensation because they were on a mission that was run by a Seventh-day Adventist or by a religious group and not by the government. And we've fought that for the last 5 years, and only in the last month people have been offered compensation monies in line with the rest of the people who are institutionalised under the Ford Inquiry. So I think that was a big feat. So even though I'm working in the area of Stolen Generations, I've been, and as Coralie, most of us have been involved in it since the day we were born, basically. So does that say, yeah, it's been a long haul. and there's still a lot of things to do with dealing with, you know, racism, disadvantage sort of situations, people not having adequate housing, all the essential services. So we've still got a long way to go in improving a lot of our people in Australia. Things that happened, especially with the apologies that and the various sort of statements made by our government, but a lot of the action they come for it hasn't really made a great change on the ground.
Do many of the issues that the Aboriginal community faces, especially when it comes to disparities or injustices, it all has its origins, I suppose, in colonization and particularly the impact of generations being stolen?
That's right, yeah. It's been, like I said, a couple of over 200 years, and we still haven't really addressed a lot of the issues. We've got unemployment problems. In Coranda, for instance, there's such exploitation of our artwork. People there may be racism, but they're not. But people don't mind selling our culture, you know, without involvement of our people. And it's changing. We've got like various reconciliation groups, and I mean, and mind, not everybody is the same, but you're actually looking at policies that are still wrong and does not include Indigenous people, or the view that they know best. And for instance, we're not even in the Australian Constitution, which I believe that they're working on now, but they're doing so without involvement of the different groups of Aboriginal people across this country. So how can you be in a country that doesn't even have you as a people included within the Constitution, not that we agree with it anyway, you know?
When you think about coming to this gathering of global Indigenous wisdom keepers in California in June, how does your work relate with, how do you see it relating with the global Indigenous efforts to reclaim land, for social justice, for so many of the same issues that you're speaking of with the stolen generation, with the impact of colonization, the whole constitutional aspect, and of course that gets into legal rights and constitutional rights as well. Do you think that this gathering will, listening to each other's stories, will strengthen the efforts that are going on in individual countries?
Oh, I certainly think so. I think that globally, most Indigenous people have suffered colonization in one way or another. And just knowing that you're not alone in what you're trying to deal with, to bring social justice and legal equity or equity across all areas, it makes a difference. And to talk about other people, maybe, then we could bring that experience back to share with those that we work with. I think a lot of Indigenous people in each country think that they stand alone, and it's really nice, it would be nice to actually look at the experiences of other countries and perhaps look at what worked and compare notes and maybe try to apply some similarities in how you deal with these issues. We haven't got all the explorers going out to explore new countries, you know, because I mean they've already done the damage, and we need to have a common as a group of Indigenous people. I think together we can.
You know, one of the issues that comes up across the board with our circle of wisdom keepers who will be gathering is concern about the environment as well as social justice. And how is it there in Australia?
Yeah, we have under the very limited native title policies, we're able to get some going back to care for our country. In Australia, it's native title, traditional ownership groups, various groups of people are responsible for the care of the country that they come from. I'm involved with the Sunset Boogie LNG native title group. We've got a huge area with huge mining impact that's within our areas. Maybe not as big as it happens within Western Australia, but always we are concerned with the destruction of our cultural sites, and then we make sure that we apply whatever cultural heritage policies or legal requirements that the government have actually developed in the past with various Aboriginal people. So we make sure that that's the issue, or we put in our own processes. So mining is an issue. Today we've actually got one of the major mining companies coming from Western Australia to look to explore on our area, and one part of that area involves one of our sacred sites. So we're very concerned, and soon we'll be meeting with those lawyers, and we'll be putting up barriers to make sure that they do not interfere with that area. So it is a concern. A lot of the cattle have damaged a lot of our country. Miners, we've got we work hard to develop a good relationship with the miners that are within our areas and the pastoralists. So together, even though it's still not as we'd like it to be, but we do try to work together to make sure that country is looked after. And we call our areas like country, as in our traditional land. So it's a bit concerning, but we can only do what we can because we're remembering that a lot of our traditional groups were taken away and removed off their tribal land. So in on the other way, we're all doing a whole lot of relearning as well, learning and finding new sites, putting cultural sort of barriers, not barriers, but cultural protection to it. We encourage a lot of our people who are taken away to go back on country. We try to run various programs for, especially for youth, so that we could develop or empower these kids so that they know that they can reach their fullest potential if they wanted to. So there's a lot of those programs too, and it's not easy. It's hard work, but we continue. But like I said, sometimes you feel and think you're isolated and you're one of a kind. So it's nice to sit down with other groups within Australia and across the country to know that you aren't battling on the same issue.
When you talk about I call it the recovery or remembrance process, how important are the arts to that, or what has been your experience of remembering the art and the drawings and the dream time? How has all of that helped in that recovery process? And we could open it up to, why don't I hear from you first, and then maybe Coralie might want to comment on that as well.
Art has been something that people actually told the stories, and it was never on the canvas as we do today. It was always handed down in story form and done in the sand or done by some form of explanation by using natural means. Or they used painted objects for ceremonies. We lost a lot of that for many, many years. And in Kuranda, there was one man called Enoch Tranby. He literally brought the art back to Kuranda, and he was the first known artist in our community that gave a lot of us our direction, and that we wanted to, you know, you see all this art on carvings or rock art, and you think, and then when you hear the stories from the old people, there's a proudness and a strengthening of who you are as a person, and the reason why you were put on this earth as an Aboriginal person, and that was to look after the country and care for your culture and care for each other. And so to draw it, to paint it from the traditional to the contemporary, it's just been a very empowering process of people and their, especially for their cultural and self-identity. Yeah, so yeah, it's been a really good, and not only that, to see the power, the pride and the excitement in the old people's eyes when they tell you the stories, it's just wonderful.
So how did you become an artist? I mean, to go from being an educator and health advocate and social justice, and now, although they do link, how did you make art a major part of your life?
Well, it's not new to my life. As kids, Coralie and I used to sit and draw or did it, we used to get into trouble over drawing and doing artwork. So we used to do these little healer girls. That's all I can remember, just to draw all the time. So as a kid, we were always painting and drawing and listening to the stories. And I went off and done nursing, and I used to get so annoyed with, in my own hometown and across the country, the exploitation of our artwork. And so I vowed that one day I would work with our artists in Taranda and try and raise the awareness and create wealth for the artists in Taranda. And probably meantime, she was my teacher way back then when we were children. She was the one into art and sewing and everything, and I loved it too, but I was heading to be a nurse and do other things at the time. But I did come back to it. It's always been in me.
People will be listening to the show, and they, you know, it's important that they have a sense of what part of Australia you're from and how that influences, especially your art, I would imagine. So where are you located in Australia?
I'm in the Taranda, far north Queensland. Taranda is in the mountains behind Cairns. I'm sure everybody would have heard about Cairns. It is a major tourism area today. It never used to be, but it is today, much to our horror. But it has been one of the industries of this region. Mana Mana is the community that we come from. Mana Mana is an Aboriginal settlement that was set up by the Seventh-day Adventist Church back in 1913, when they got the children from the communities and dragged them halfway across Queensland to put them onto various missions. And it so happened that my grandmother ended up as a Western Yalanji or some Tetsubi Yalanji person, ended up on Mana Mana Mission. That's my father's side. My mother's side. Her father was Jiru, but her grandmother was actually stolen from Red Lynch and part of the Jabiru Nation. And it so happened that her mother died, her grandfather brought the children back to Mana Mana, which is to be on Jabiru country, and then after, much to his horror, after he wanted to take them back to Innisfail, he found that he couldn't because they were now wards of the state of Queensland because he went onto a mission. And so anyway, that's my beginning, and my mother and father are actually married, and I ended up, and because we were one of the second groups of families that moved and got an exemption certificate to move out of Mana Mana to live amongst the non-Indigenous people, so they came into Taranda and we've lived here ever since. And that was in 1953 they moved to Taranda. So Taranda is a village in the rainforest, beautiful country, with a community of about 1,200 Aboriginal people. And you've got, we've got a business community, an Aboriginal community and a local group of community and industry. The tourist industry is dying, so there's not much industry in Taranda. My father was a timber cutter. He cut timber for most of his life around the region. In those days they never paid Aboriginal people full salary, but even on the salary that he earned, he actually provided for his large family and most of the community. So he was a generous man, and someone who he did a lot for a lot of people, and we enjoyed being here. He's one of the, or back in those days, the only person who owned property, Aboriginal person who owned property, and now there's a few more that bought houses, which is good. But he's been a good example to others that on achievement. I'm from a big family.
And I remember being there. It was so beautiful and not that far away from the ocean as well.
Yeah, and at the mission, when they were all living in the mission, they used to run from the mission across the mountain down to Wangetti Beach and swim there and run back again at the end of the day. So the, even though we think because it's up high in the mountain, people do have quick access to the ocean, but we call ourselves mountain goats.
We're afraid of the sea. I think, well, we come from a very strong family who've always got truth and justice for our people. Then Karanda improved a lot of people that were part of the Underground Railroad, and Coralie and I grew up in that strength of fighting for justice.
One of the memories that I have being there is how active your family was in the community, and
yeah,
how passionate and caring and loving they were in regards to their work. And that very much impressed me. So I think that you model what you speak. You know, sometimes people talk a lot about what they can do. But one of the experiences that I had with you when we were there on the Trail of Dreams World Peace Walk was actually seeing you live into what you believe, and that was a beautiful thing.
Oh, that's nice. And then, like I said, it wasn't something we just acquired. We actually were born into that type of behavior in our family. We've had a good family.
Let's talk about your artwork. You've committed your whole life to your art. Why has that been so important to you?
Art became part of my life because I grew up with it. I sort of watched our mothers make our clay. But I used to be with Glenna's mum and my mum together, they're sisters. And from there, I sort of never looked back. When I got married, I made my own clothes, everything like that for my children, just watching our mums. And art sort of... I used to do other artwork, like painting streets and things like that. And then when the cultural part of me came in, they used to talk about ochre, and I didn't know what ochre was. And ochre was the type of paint that they used when they first started to paint their bodies and everything. So looking at those pictures and everything of our people dressed up in their quadri and everything, that's how I sort of came really, really interested in about our culture and art.
And bringing that alive in your community and seeing more and more people becoming involved with the cultural art, how do you feel about that? What have you seen? Or I should say, what has been one of the greatest benefits of that to the community?
The dancing part. What really got me into it too is that they asked the Jabiru people to they had a dancing thing here, and it was dancing everything that actually got everybody involved again. So the cultural part of us all came back in the last 20 odd years, so that's where it really all hit everybody back here in Karanda.
Would you say that you are self-taught? I mean, I'm looking at some of your art even as we're talking. I'm looking at what Glenda sent me, and I see the doorway, the painting, the door, and I see another painting. It doesn't have a title on it, but it looks like platypus.
Yes.
Gaming, maybe?
The platypus is... Glenda is named after a platypus, and that's one of our main little animals here in Glenda, and that's where Noombay gets its name. Platypus, our housing colour here, that's called Noombay. And the other door one came in, that's over the last 5 years that the painting is starting to change a bit now, to wider areas, not just, you know, like it's going to... like the black and the white one. That's what that painting is all about, that everybody has these problems and we've got to try and sort ourselves out, you know, that sort of thing. So it's not just an Aboriginal painting on the door.
Very powerful. And what about when you talk about cultural art, I see the picture of you with the didgeridoo, and I'm sure there's some clapsticks in there somewhere. And one of the things that we learned on the journey that I didn't know before is that the didgeridoo is a man's instrument and the clapstick is the women's instrument.
Don't ever play that didgeridoo, please. Okay?
You're allowed to stand
nearer, though. You can stand nearer, but don't play it. That's true. Women aren't allowed to play it because it's a men's instrument. With the little clapstick things, the women had to use those things when they used to gather and hunt. But they used to dig with those sort of things. That's used for a lot of things in them days. And today we just use it as musical instruments and that sort of thing now.
So in Australia today, women still do not play the didgeridoo? And the only reason I ask that question is because in many places where I travel, the didgeridoo has become very popular, and you see women and men playing that instrument. How do you feel about that?
I don't feel too good about it because I think Glenys said she'll explain that.
I was just thinking because the didgeridoo is not a Queensland thing either. It's a territory.
No, where we are, it got introduced into, like, where we are, Queensland, that sort of thing. It actually came on a boat. It came through trading from the Northern Territory. And then from the Northern Territory, it sort of landed here and went down the coastline and it sort of went all over the place. And so that's where the story comes in from the Northern Territory. About the didgeridoo, so we've got to learn to respect that one, you know, on the pitch. So maybe when we get out of there, we'll explain it properly about the didgeridoo.
So what would be considered an indigenous instrument of the northern country?
We didn't have no musical thing before the clapstick. That would be the most musical instrument we would have had here because it was used for everything, fighting, dancing, ceremonies, all those sort of things. That's going to be our musical sort of instrument here in this area. And for fighting, we had actually a sword, a huge sword.
They called it the Jabberjee sword, or they had another name, but the swords were often taller than the Jabberjee people. The Jabberjee people were very short people of the rainforest.
When we were on our way up to Kuranda, I think we were down in, well, several different communities, I remember, and we met women there who were remembering their dances and bringing them back to the community. Have you noticed an increase of the remembrance of dances and different ways, ceremonial ways in the community there?
We had a few elders that were doing these dances for us, and they actually taught us when we actually went to join this dance group just down the range from us. So we had elders here teaching us dancing of like the Barron River, for instance. There were dances on those things. That was in the women's one day. And then we had like mosquito dances, all the insects, the animal dances of how the women would do it and the men had their own way of doing it. And then in the end, we all sort of meet up together to do all these dances, the men and the women. Today, the little boys and girls doing it today. Not many of us are doing it at the moment.
And you've got to consider that this colonisation and the forced removal of lots and lots of people, that a lot of the traditional ways of doing things was lost, unless they did try and practice it on the missions. They were actually punished, jailed, or publicly flogged. And there was an attempt to wipe that language, wipe out any kind of traditional practice, and so the fact that it's coming back and being taught by the older people, two people like Coralie and the rest of us, and Coralie who taught the rest of us, and it's just amazing. Like I said, it's empowering. It's empowering to the individual, and the dances and the stories told of how to live in the traditional way, how to care for that country, how to hunt for various foods and who could eat them and who couldn't eat them, who you could marry and who you couldn't. So it's not just
dancing. It's dancing with a story of telling you how to live as a society. And every 2 years, they have a big dance festival called Laura Festival, and that's where everybody from all over the Cape meets for about 4 days or something, and they do all their dancing and traditional dancing, and that's where we've learned a lot from other dancers as well.
And bringing all the groups together, like they did come together for ceremonial purposes and marriages, etc.
It sounds like very similar to the powwows here in the Native American community. Yeah. And here, the Native American community, starting in the spring when the weather gets good, there are gatherings that happen in different communities, and they're called powwows. And different tribes come together, and they share dances and beadwork and food and stories, and the elders, you know, they tell the stories and demonstrate traditional ways.
That is lovely, and that's always a major event. And when we call it big Murray events happen of all the different tribes, and they all come together. And today it's either with sports or with the festival, as Coralie mentioned, or with other weddings or concerts and things like that.
Are you finding markets for the art? I mean, has it been doing what you wanted it to do? I know you had you were very enthusiastic when I was there about starting your business. Has the downturn in the tourist industry affected you, or are you finding markets in other parts of the country and world?
Affected me significantly. Well, 2008 we did good, in 2007, 2008. And then 2009, I think, the 9/11 thing, then the big cyclone came and the money fell out of that. Wasn't it that some economical crash? So we just went from bad to worse. In the end, I gave it up, but I could actually do a little site, and Polly and I still sell art, and we've got a website getting set up to a Melbourne company. So we still sell art, but it's not open in your face out in the main street. You know, we don't have money to keep on doing that. If the rent was too much people didn't want to pay lots of big money for authentic stuff.
Well, we had this conversation last night, and it was it brought back a lot of memories of traveling through Australia, particularly with the Aboriginal communities. And one situation that came to mind was we had a unique opportunity to interview some of the men from different Aboriginal communities or countries, and they talked about how important the arts have been for their own recovery from alcoholism or getting out of the system and being able to return to their country. And I also talked about the arts as a way of awakening them. I remember one of the young men said, you know, when we were separated from the land, it wasn't just about the land. It was we were separated from our song lines. We were separated from the spirit that makes us who we are. And so it was quite interesting to observe how communities were embracing dance and storytelling and performing musical programs. We went to several, and revering the elders for the fact that the elders were the ones who held that memory store, if you will, or that treasure of their connection to something that went beyond the stolen generation, because that certainly had almost like a tear in the fabric of the people and their connection, the Aboriginal communities and their connection to the land and to each other. So I wanted to really thank Glynis and Coralie for being on on Now Time Indigenous Voices and sharing their experiences as artists and activists. And I wanted to also thank them for recommending some of the music that we had an opportunity to listen to. I want to play a song called Spirit Alive by Christian Benton, and this was highly recommended by Glennis, and I believe this music was produced right in Coranda. Thanks again to our family from Down Under. We look forward to connecting with them, with the United Religions Initiative, Global Indigenous Initiative Gathering that will be taking place in outside of San Francisco in June. I wanted to bring your attention to a trailer for a movie called Bridge Walkers. And I want to play this trailer for you, the audio portion, on the Now Time Radio Indigenous Voices, and encourage you to go to the website and Google Bridge Walkers. I think this is going to be quite a profound work, and encourage many of you to take advantage of an opportunity to see this and even be a part of the fundraising to help make sure this beautiful film gets released on a larger scale across the country and beyond.
The greatest obstacle the world have experienced is the ice in the heart of man, that inability to connect to each other, that loss of ceremony.
To Indigenous people, Earth is sacred. Their walk upon Earth is sacred. The Indigenous people have a gift to give all people. Their gift is their walk.
The prophecy said that it would be the Indigenous people who would come from the four corners of the world. And it would be the Indigenous people that would be given the responsibility of leadership to bring a vision
that can bring unity in this world, that could unite mankind.
Teach children, teach people about the land, the ceremonies, the prayers. It's how we have to protect our Mother Earth.
When we come together as a people, all races, red, yellow, black, and white, it's like one heart, one mind, one spirit.
Anax! Anax! Awe! Hey!
How do we build a bridge for understanding, for unity?
We can create an energy shift upon Mother Earth. And you got to have faith, you got to have belief that each and every one of us have that power.
Follow four bridgewalkers on their walk today. Cross bridges with them between the mind and the heart, between ancient and modern, between hurt and healing, between material and spiritual. Experience the spirit of the Indigenous.
All nations, all faith, one prayer.
Again, Google Bridge Walkers and find out more about this very powerful film and how you can help promote the film and be involved in the efforts to take the film to theaters across the country and beyond. Help support the elders who are a part of this project, bringing powerful messages for us at a time when, you know, on the earth, we really need to think about what is our relationship? What does relationship mean to us? And what is our relationship to the earth? What is our relationship to each other? What is our relationship to ourselves? And how do we express that? How do we give meaning to that relationship in the choices that we make each and every day? And what relationships do we build across the bridges in our lives. And many of us, all of us, have an opportunity to create bridges that take us beyond the borders that we tend to live within. So how do we go forward? How do we extend ourselves out to Mother Earth and all of our family and yet be rooted in what it is that makes us who we are and makes us strong? And so I wanted to, as we leave our radio program today, you've been listening to Indigenous Voices on Now Time Radio. I want to encourage you to check back with us in a couple of weeks. We'll be journeying down into Latin America. And instead of being one country specific, we're going to be engaging in conversation and sharing with Indigenous communities, with four different Indigenous communities. So 2 weeks from now, join us again at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Indigenous Voices on Now Time Radio. Indigenous Voices comes to you through a partnership with the United Religions Initiative, Global Indigenous Initiative, and Now Time Radio. Thank you for being a part of our show today. Have a great week.